Hello, hello, OdaFest Podcast. This is Angelo, and I'm here with Nancy.
It's just me.
And this is the 29th episode of the season, and this is also your 30-day warning. If you are hearing this, it is less than 1 month until OdaFest. Do you have your tickets?
Do you hear
Do
that,
you have
Angelo?
Your hotel room?
I think a lot of mental alarms just went off.
It's as if 1,000 cosplayers just screamed out all at once.
I think I just felt the overall adrenaline spike in the city go up by 60%.
Cortisol, too.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my.
Oh,
but
my.
Don't worry, because we've got a great show for you guys coming at OdaFest, because the tables are spinning. Double time. Welcome to OdaFest Amplify 2026, Advanced Ratio, and Mayonnaise Music. Advanced Ratio is a Calgary-born DJ and producer operating since 2019. He has a particular focus on blending Japanese pop culture with high-energy dance genres such as J-Core, Machina, D&B, and Funkot. He loves Vocaloid and idol music, but he also loves to dig into anisong and otaku subculture music. He is always looking forward to stepping on stage to share the music he loves in unique and unexpected ways, to get the audience singing along to their favorite anthems and discovering new favorites. Follow Advanced Ratio on SoundCloud. Mayonnaise is an electronic music producer based in Canada, known for his innovative anime and Vocaloid remixes, blending elements of various electronic genres. He has performed at some of Vancouver's top nightclubs, such as Levels in Aurum, multiple online music events, and in addition to playing many times for Tokyo Tonight and AniRevo. He has collaborated with groups such as Universal, The Nunbu Project, Anison Hijack, and Shears 39. He continues to push the boundaries of his craft, creating high energy and memorable experiences for his audience. Follow Mayonnaise on SoundCloud.
And don't miss your chance to meet Leah and take home a signed keepsake. Each day features a different way to access her exclusive autograph sessions. On Friday, autograph access is available only with the purchase of Leah CDs made on site at OdaFest. Saturday, entry is through an autograph lottery system, so sign up for your chance to be selected. Winners will be notified with session details. On Sunday, autograph access is available with qualifying purchases of Leah CDs or official Leah merchandise made at OdaFest. Purchases made on previous days will still be valid for entry into Sunday's autograph session. Spots are limited for all sessions, so please make sure to plan ahead and don't miss this special opportunity to meet Leah in person. For more information, including the autograph limitations, head to odafest.com/Leah.
It's getting to me. It's creeping up. I'm feeling it every single day. Oh my lord, oh my god, I'm not ready.
It's coming.
It's too soon. It really is too soon.
It kind of feels like we got a head start on spring this time.
You think so?
Yeah, I do.
It was literally snowing this weekend.
Yeah, but then we had a thunderstorm this afternoon.
Oh, did we?
We did.
I was inside at work and I didn't notice.
I didn't notice either.
I don't know. I feel like because spring has been so snowy so far, it feels like it hasn't even started. Like, OdaFest is coming up. It is usually extremely hot, very summery. I'm still in winter mode.
I feel the spring coming. And the reason why is because I have a yard and I see the plants. They're turning green. I see little green buds, little green tendrils. They're poking up out of the dirt. They're poking up out of what little bit of snow is currently left on my yard. But it's there. And that's why I say it feels like spring. Because there's more light. Things are growing again. It's really nice. And it feels like it started a little earlier than usual.
Ah, you know, I'm kind of there. Both of my maple trees have started to bloom, have started to leaf. They are looking very nice. Hooray! I am excited. I'm excited once the temperature gets high enough where I can put them outside. They'll get a lot of light. They'll develop their nice red color, their deep red color.
Mm. Mm. I love maples. I love those. I love them.
Yeah. Having a couple of Japanese maples just makes me so happy.
Yeah, and because I saw a whole bunch of stuff kind of greening out in the yard, I thought to myself a couple weeks ago, I should probably try and start those tomato seeds I kept from my crazy, crazy harvest of tomatoes last year. So I kept not very many. I kept 7 seeds. I kind of just scattered them into a little seed starter pot with just a bunch of soil, and I'm watering it every day. It has already started sprouting. One of the sprouts is like a solid 3 inches tall now.
Oh, my God.
And I have more. So I told my mom about this because I was so proud. I was like, Mom, look, the tomatoes last year, the ones you gave me, I kept some seeds and now we get to have them again. And she's like, oh, well, while you're doing that, can you start some of kale and some of these heirloom tomatoes? And also, I would like you to have some of these sweet pea flowers. And she just like went on. So now I have a little collection of seed starters because she wanted some kale plants.
God, you tried to have a conversation with your mom and you got homework instead.
But here's the thing. I don't have a fancy setup like Jay does. I don't have like an actual little hothouse, you know, apparatus or apparati, yeah. I guess, because he's probably got multiple of them. But like, I just got a nice sunny window in the front and a couple of little old takeout containers that I washed and put soil in, and now I've got seeds in them.
They were dirty, and then you made them not dirty, and then you made them excessively dirty.
And now they will feed me. My takeout will feed me more.
Oh, no. Why would you eat out of a dirty takeout container? There's dirt in there.
Delicious, probably. delicious dirt.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
So I have a little collection of, like, you can buy little seed starters. They come as little, like, pucks that are about maybe 2 loonies wide. They're about a centimeter tall. And then you just add water to them.
And then they just blow up. They get big.
And then you just put seeds in them because they've got soil, because they were just compressed soil, basically, and paper. And then when they're done, you know, sprouting, you just kind of drop the whole thing in some soil outside or in a pot, and then you're good. So I've got 6 of those sitting on my windowsill and a bunch of tomato sprouts.
Nice.
I'm so excited.
That's really exciting. I hope that your tomatoes are juicy and succulent.
So delicious.
But what's even more delicious, I heard that you failed. Failed at bread.
I did. Okay. Anyone who's been listening to this podcast knows that sometime over the pandemic, I got a sourdough starter from a coworker, and I have somehow kept it going this whole time. How do you say no to sourdough? It's not even that much effort. You can make it anytime throughout the week. You just leave your starter in the fridge, and you don't have to worry about feeding it every day. And then you just get loaves of bread. Except for when you leave your sourdough out and you forget to bake it.
Oh, no.
So work has been excessively busy for me in most of my careers. I can't believe I have to say that, in most of my careers, including the 5th job that I picked up that Angelo made fun
Jesus.
Of me for.
Miss 5 jobs over here, 1 for every finger.
One for every finger on my one hand. But that leaves a whole other hand full of fingers.
For hobbies, hopefully.
For hobbies.
For relaxing.
For sleep.
Please.
for D&D with Angelo.
Yeah.
But yeah, so things got stupid last week. Just absolutely stupid. I had enough Enough of a lunch break one day and enough sense of mind that I needed to make more bread, so I made more bread. But I didn't finish making the bread. I made the dough. I mixed the sourdough starter in. I had very wet dough. I, you know, mixed it all around. And then I covered it, because it's Calgary and it's dry here. So I covered it and I let it proof. And I let it proof. And I let it proof. And I was supposed to bake it at like 8 p.m., you know. Bake it for an hour, you get like a nice hot loaf of bread, wait for it to cool down for a couple hours, put it away, and then I've got fresh bread for breakfast the next day. Well,
you
I went
see,
straight
the problem
to bed.
There,
mm-hmm.
The problem there is that when the bread is coming out of the oven is when you want to go to bed, right?
Yeah.
It should be coming out of the oven like 20 minutes before you want to eat. Because like bread fresh out of the oven... There is not quite a feeling quite like that. It is so wonderful.
I agree. However, as with most oven uses, you don't want to leave it unsupervised. So when you're baking bread, you want to make sure that you never miss the timer, because if you miss the timer, you've now either overbaked it or you've set something on fire. So
one of the two.
Yeah, you don't want either of those outcomes realistically. So I went to bed. I like literally just like zombie walked right past it. It was on the kitchen counter, put in a place where I should see it when I'm going to bed. But no, I was tired and I zombie walked the whole way to bed. And so I forgot about it. I slept. And the next morning, the alarm goes off. I'm really tired. I didn't sleep well. I get up. I'm in the shower and I'm waking up slowly in the shower and it hits me and it's like, oh no, I still have dough downstairs. I didn't make bread. I didn't make the bread. I half made the bread and then I forgot the bread and now it is still just dough. So
I had a similar situation happen.
Oh no.
Last Thursday, I didn't sleep good. I had some ribs in the fridge. And I was like, if I don't have these ribs for breakfast, they are going to go bad.
Oh, no.
So I put them in the microwave. And then 3 p.m. rolls around at work, and I'm like, those ribs are still in the microwave.
No. That's so sad.
Yeah.
That's so sad. Oh, no.
But I mean... In your case, you were able to salvage the situation.
Yeah. So, okay. So I come downstairs. I run over to where the dough is. And the dough has pushed the lid a solid inch and a half up off the lip of the bowl it's in.
That's some powerful yeast right there.
It's... So when the dough is completely deflated... And it rises to three times its size, it still doesn't touch the lid on this glass bowl that I use. This was so incredibly overproofed, it had poked straight up and pushed the entire lid off the glass bowl by a solid inch and a half.
Impressive.
And it was still going. So I had to try and just gently remove the lid. Like, you don't want to just pull it off, because if you do, you deflate all of the dough. So I, like, had to gently kind of, like, peel it back really, really slowly and try not to pop any bubbles. And I successfully, somehow, I did. This is the joy of using silicone reusable lids, is that the bottom is very, very nonstick. It's very shiny.
Yeah.
It still clings, so you can't, like, it's not completely nonstick, it's not like Teflon, but, like, you can generally get things that are wet to just sort of detach slowly. So I did, and then I look at it, and I'm like, I can't do anything with you. Like, if I try to move you, you will just completely deflate, you're so overproofed, you're never gonna rise if I just try and bake you again. So I put a baking sheet over it and I turned it over gently and then I slowly lifted the glass bowl off and it just barely detached. But it held its form really, really well. Like, it just looked like an entire, like, overturned bowl shaped. It's kind of like when, in the 80s or 90s or whenever that was, when Jell-O molds were, like, super popular. It's like I just decanted a Jell-O mold, but it was the perfect shape of the glass bowl just sitting right there on top of a baking sheet. And I'm like, okay, what can
That's
I do with this?
Did you give it a nice little slap?
I did definitely do that thing where I grabbed the sides of the baking sheet and I just sort of jiggled it a little bit, and it really jiggled. It
really jiggled.
I was like, this is insane. I hope this holds its shape.
Bread jello.
Bread jello. Basically what dough is. Unbaked bread jello. So now I've got this giant, like, dome of dough sitting on a baking sheet, and I'm like, okay, wait, we just had focaccia last night. If I move this around a little bit and I dimple it and I put some oil over it and I sprinkle a bunch of salt on it, I can just try and turn this into focaccia.
Yeah.
So I did.
Nice.
And I went all out. I, like, sprinkled salt on it. I put, like, herbs and pepper on top. And I used the nice truffle oil.
Ooh, oh my God.
And then I put it in the oven and I turn it on. But while it's heating up, because I have one of those small, like, countertop ovens, it heats up really, really fast. So you don't really need to do that whole, like, preheat dance. And I'm frantically looking up on my phone, like, a recipe. It's like, how long do I bake focaccia for? Good news, it bakes at the same temperature as my sourdough normally does, and it bakes for almost exactly the same amount of time. So I just put it in there, leave it be, and then I come back, and I've got a slightly misshapen but still very rectangular and very, very fluffy focaccia that was made with sourdough.
Nice. Ooh.
And we devoured the heck out of that. I have not gone through a loaf of bread like that in that sort of speed in a while. Like, probably since I first started making sourdough and I finally figured out how to get it to rise really, really nicely. But this was such a different format for the same dough to take. It was so good.
It is insane how your brain is just tickled in a different way when you have this baked loaf that is slathered in oil. It's absorbed all of that the entire time. It has browned beautifully on the outside. It is just, you cut it, you don't need anything else to go along with it.
No.
You just put it into your mouth and you're done.
Yep.
Like, did you let it cool for like 10, 15 minutes and then cut into it immediately?
Basically, yes. I cut an entire strip off one side of it and I just ate the whole thing.
Yeah, it is hard to overstate how just, it's almost instinctual.
It's
how
magic.
It just floods your brain with happy chemicals.
It's just magic. And I genuinely feel for people who can't have gluten, because you're missing out on just this really lizard brain reaction to fluffy warm bread.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it really is like watching Dungeon Meshi and heckin' Senshi going absolutely insane over bread. No,
yep.
that reaction is entirely justified.
And keep in mind, this was a failure. Like, I wasn't supposed to be making focaccia. And to be fair to all of the purists out there, it was an olive oil. My truffle oil is an olive oil.
Oh, perfect. Honestly, so if any purists out there are saying anything, it's like, how dare you take a sourdough starter and use that for focaccia? Instead of, like, making a much higher, like, closer to, like, 80% hydration dough, I don't know how much of a difference that would make.
But honestly,
I'm sure it was delicious.
Honestly, for a Frankenbread that I made out of a failure of a sourdough bread, it was great.
Yeah.
And I would do it again. And guess what? I did do it again. The following week, I deliberately tried to overproof my bread this time and just bake it in the loaf pan right after I overproofed it. But I would try to overproof it in the pan it was supposed to bake in. So here's the thing. When you bake sourdough, you need to have a lid over top of it for the majority of the baking because the steam helps it rise. Otherwise, okay. the crust forms too quickly and it never gets a chance to actually rise nicely. You kind of get like a really dense bread if you do it that way. And that's why some people actually take oven-safe bowls and just put it over their sourdough, and they put it in the oven like on top of a pizza rock, basically.
Yeah.
The other way a lot of people do this is they will just make the bread in a Dutch oven. So they'll preheat the Dutch oven, and then they open the lid carefully and try and drop the dough in, and then they just bake it that way. Also works really well.
Yeah, the Dutch oven method is what I've normally seen.
So I have a loaf pan that comes with a lid, and that lid I left on because I needed it to proof. So I left it to proof overnight just like I did last time, except, oh, I was being smart this time. I don't need to relocate the dough. Now I can just stick the whole thing in the oven. Now, this loaf pan is gigantic. Anytime I've ever made a sourdough loaf in it, it never touches the edges, like the lengthwise edges, never touches it. It's just never been that big of a loaf. Well, it turns out that when you overproof it overnight on purpose, the bread kind of just explodes out of the corners. So I came downstairs very happy to bake fresh bread in the morning, and the corners had dough just coming out of it. It was weird. It was
Oh my
weird.
God.
It was genuinely weird. It kind of looked like there were tentacles coming out of it.
Oh no.
Little
oh
bread
my
tentacles.
God.
So I had to do the thing where I try to slowly take the lid off, make sure everything inside is okay, and I did, and it was perfectly rectangular. I made a perfectly rectangular loaf of bread.
Almost like bread maker bread.
Yeah, except it was extraordinarily perfectly rectangular. And yeah, it was the fluffiest bread I've ever had, but it was perfectly rectangular.
You know, some people would say it's hip to be square. I'm not going to judge your rectangle bread. I'm not going to judge it at all.
It was still good. It was really fluffy. And it was one of those, you know how you can make shokupan and it's like a sponge. You can basically try and compress it as much as you want, but it always bounces back. That's how fluffy this stuff was.
Nice.
You could try and squish it between your fingers and it would just bounce back.
That is, oh my God, I'm a little bit jealous. I'm a little bit jealous. Oh.
I mean, I could just send you home with a loaf next time.
I would absolutely take all of your bread, 100%.
My only request is that you would have to bring a container with you because I don't have enough containers to spare.
Understandable.
Do it.
I'll just make one out of freezer paper. I'll just like staple a bunch of freezer paper into a roughly bread bag shape.
The poor man's bread bag.
Exactly.
Amazing. Well, this is turning into a really weird journey. I'm now just like making it up. I guess I've hit a level of bread making where I can just make it up and it's
fine.
You're
just winging it.
And that's weird and cool. But weird to know that I've reached this level of bread baking.
No, it's something of a mastery of this skill. You've done a lot of stuff. You've figured it out. You've developed your intuition for certain things to the point where, well, at this point, you can just experiment, you know? You can just be like, okay, this worked out this way. If I just tweak one thing, what's going to happen? And then you just try it, and you enjoy it, and you see.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Ah. Now, in other news, last weekend, Dio and I unceremoniously ditched Nancy and Sean and Nikki. Also that, instead of D&D, we could go to a movie instead.
I couldn't believe you did that to us.
I can, because it was a really good movie.
I wanted to see that movie.
So Exit 8 came out. Exit 8, if you are not familiar with the property, was an indie game based on the Shinjuku train station, the Shinjuku subway station. It is such an insane, convoluted train station that people have always talked about getting lost in it. Dio and I have gotten lost in it. In fact, when we were drunk was the only time we actually made our way through it without getting lost. Crazy. Exit 8, the indie game, is something of a paranormal, something of a horror game, where you have to walk through the same hallway over and over and over again, trying to look for anomalies, things that are not correct. Maybe a poster is different. Maybe the guy who's walking down the hall is just staring into your soul. And if any weird shit happens, you turn around and hightail it. Otherwise, it resets the counter and you have to keep walking. You have to keep going.
That's nuts.
Notice how I didn't say that there's any kind of story at all. Because there isn't any kind of story at all. Sure, the opportunity for maybe atmospheric storytelling with different anomalies could have been there. But there was nothing of the sort. That didn't exist. And so suddenly a movie for Exit 8 is announced. And everybody is like, the trailer looks great. What story are you guys doing? What? Excuse me? I went into it. I'd seen the trailer. I'd seen people play the game. I hadn't actually played the game myself at that point. But I knew that there was no story. And immediately, they start setting up some characters. They start setting up some story beats. And while I would say that it's not the best movie ever, I don't think anybody would go into Exit 8 and come out disappointed. I think that it was extremely, extremely interesting. We got lore for the walking man. There was the guy that walks down the hallway in the opposite direction. We got lore for him. I didn't expect lore. We got it. That was great.
Fantastic.
It gave us a lot of interesting stuff. It gave us a lot of, like, a little bit of world building even. The payoff. The payoff on some of the anomalies was huge. It felt so good. At the same time, my biggest criticism is just sometimes the characters behave like movie characters, if you know what I mean.
Oh, I see.
If you were walking down a cursed hallway that keeps resetting your progress every time you miss something, and you're walking down it, and suddenly, like, a tsunami siren starts going off, what would you do?
Probably shouldn't be there.
You would probably immediately turn around and hightail it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Would you stand in the middle of the hallway, scratching your head, being like, well, this is weird. I wonder what that siren is all about. I hear some water rushing towards me. This is quite the pickle I'm in. Let me just check my watch. I might have been here for about 30, 40 seconds now, waiting for these events to unfold. Oh my god, is that a wall of water? This is quite a situation I find myself.
So,
sometimes they don't behave rationally.
Yeah.
And I get that they do that for the tension, for the events to happen. I am criticizing it, even if I enjoyed the movie.
I mean, no properties that I can remember right now successfully completely avoid having to hand the characters the stupid stick.
Yeah. Yeah, giving the characters the stupid stick, it is just, I understand it, but sometimes they are just really, really, really stupid when they're holding the stupid stick.
Yep.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that is a just part of it. Like, I'm sad that you said that, because now it's going to bother me so much more when I do go and watch it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I've
implanted you with cursed knowledge.
It's okay.
But I absolutely do recommend the movie. I really, really did enjoy it, to the point where I actually did go out and play the game myself. I wanted to experience it myself.
Yeah. I was going to say, doesn't it make you want to play the game?
Yeah. And so my first run through of the game, I was so confident that I was just going to one try it. I was so here for it. I was like, yep, gonna immediately take care of this game. It's not gonna pull the wool over my eyes. I'm so damn smart. I've watched streamers, I've watched VTubers, I've watched the movie, for Christ's sake. So I got through the game in 15 minutes.
That's actually pretty good.
That was amazing. That was amazing. And so I was like, well, let's do it again.
Let's get a full half hour out of this, baby.
So round two took me 55 minutes.
Wait, what? Why? Why did it take you three times longer?
So Exit 8, the way that it works, it tries not to show you anomalies that you've already seen until you've completed them all. Like, it will keep a tally. If I remember correctly, there's something like 20 or 30 different anomalies in the game. And when you see an anomaly, you're supposed to turn around and go the other way. So anytime you turn around and go the other way, it's like, ah, you saw this anomaly, so I'm not showing it to you again. So the first time, I got through it in 15 minutes. It was extremely quick. I was getting all of these very obvious anomalies, and I was able to turn around, and I think I only got my progress reset maybe two or three times. The second round, I literally went through all of the other anomalies. I would keep getting to the sixth anomaly or the seventh in a row. Like, because you have to go through the hallway. You have to correctly guess whether the hallway was anomaly-free or had an anomaly 8 times in a row. And I kept getting it wrong around 6 or 7. 6 or 7. 6, 7.
No! You're not allowed.
Listen.
Not in my podcast.
I'm late 30s. By me using it, it's going to kill 6, 7.
Yeah.
I am doing my due diligence for all of us.
For making things uncool.
Exactly. That is my power. That is the power vested to me by official Unk status.
Fair enough.
I legitimately went through 55 minutes in round two. It was almost 4 times longer. Because I kept getting tripped up by very, very small things. Things like a very light face on the ceiling. Barely perceptible. Oh.
Does it tell you when you miss the anomaly what it was?
No.
Didn't think so.
If you miss it, if you miss it, it will show you again. It will bring it back to you. So you could possibly get tripped up on the same anomaly 5 or 6 times before you finally find it.
That's nuts.
Yeah. It is. It really is pretty crazy. And some of the anomalies are very subtle things. They could be like, oh, there's a camera on the ceiling. There's a red dot on that camera that usually isn't there. Okay. But then there's some that are active jump scares.
Oh no, I hate jump scares.
There's the guy who walks the other way. And it's very common, you'll get halfway down the hallway. You'll turn around to see if you missed anything, and he'll just be there, staring directly at you. And you're like, oh my god! Or things like, you walk halfway down the hallway, and suddenly you're met with a tsunami coming your way, and you have to run the other way.
Hmm.
It is a really fun game. Even if the replay value isn't massive, it is a fun game.
I feel like as someone who hasn't watched streamers do it, I should try just to see how bad I am at it.
I think if you haven't watched too much of it, I think playing it first will make the movie feel better.
Probably.
Because the same frustration that you had, you will see it in them.
Mm.
You will see it in the characters in the movie.
Mm. Yeah, I could see that. Oof. Okay, well, how long is it in theaters for? I can go watch it.
I'm not certain. I'm really not. It is a Japanese language film. It has English subtitles. And these sort of movies don't usually stick around in theaters for very long.
Yeah.
But I do absolutely recommend it. If you don't see it in theaters, get it on whatever streaming site picks it up. It's a really fun time. I really did enjoy it.
Yeah.
All right. Unlike. So, I really enjoy Invincible. It is an Amazon Prime cartoon. Superhero cartoon.
Uh-huh.
It's really enjoyable. It's really fun. But uh-huh. There's one thing about it. One thing about it that just really, really, really rustles my jimmies. And this is something that happens in a lot of shonen anime as well. But it feels so much worse in Invincible than in a lot of other things. And it is power scaling. So, in Invincible, our main boy, Mark, he is what is known as a Viltrumite, which are the most powerful beings in the known universe. They're basically space fascists. They use their power for might makes right. And he was born and raised on Earth, so he just happens to have not insanity as a personality trait.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
But the things that we see them do over the course of the series are things like throwing a baseball around the Earth so fast that it would be going 1,400 miles per second. You know, just casually throwing baseballs at relativistic speeds. Things like throwing someone through multiple skyscraper buildings, picking up giant boats and swinging them like baseball bats, flying to the moon to punch someone in a few seconds, like going half the speed of light suddenly, you know, things of that nature. And this is all very casual, not really expanded upon. Taking bullets, just like being shot at, bullets fly off. But suddenly, like, a random guy who turns into a dinosaur is able to bite into you. Excuse me? Okay, like, I understand that to have any threat at all, just run-of-the-mill villains have to be able to do something to our main guy. But then there was this one very specific scene in the last episode where three of these Viltrum guys and another alien guy who's just as strong as them are trying to push a spaceship that's going to fall on a city, right? And there's an ocean right beside the city. So it's like, oh, they're going to go fly up. They're going to push it over to the ocean. And they are having a hell of a time. They can't stop it from falling. They're like struggling. And then the next scene, they push it out into space.
What?
Exactly. And it's like, guys.
What?
The ocean was right there. If you were having trouble, if you were struggling, if you were truly putting as much effort as it looked like you were putting into it, you would have just pushed the spaceship over there. Instead, the four of you decided to stop its descent and then get to escape velocity and just put it into orbit. It's going to like go around. It's going to fall back on this planet eventually. You guys didn't do a very good job. it just has sometimes the most pants on head writing. And I'm just, it takes me out of it. It takes me out of the experience.
Yeah. There was a movie we recently watched that was like that. It was by the same director who did Belle. So he came out with a new movie, I think it was this year or last year, called Scarlet. And it is based loosely on a Shakespearean play. Things get really messy in the middle, and there's like, there are a series of events. I'm not going to say anything because I feel like I'd spoil everything if I did. There's a series of events that are really, really, really weird to explain and don't really constitute scene continuity in any way, shape, or form. And generally, if you've never watched a movie with me, like, you know, at home, not in a theater, I'd never do this in a theater, but at home, if we're watching a movie, you can tell when I start getting upset at a movie if I actually start saying things out loud about the movie.
I've actually noticed that when we have our anime days. When something is truly, truly bad, you will unmute your mic to be like, what the actual fuck did we just watch?
Yes.
Why are they doing this?
Because otherwise, I'm just like, okay, we can all enjoy whatever we're watching in silence, so we can all enjoy the property the way that it was meant to be enjoyed. And then we can have, like, side chatter. We'll have text chat on the side or whatever. You know, just, like, running commentary or, like, notes about things that we notice or something. But there's a certain level of upset that I get where I just unmute and I just start talking to the TV. And that happened a bunch at Scarlet. I was just like,
oh no.
I'm sorry. Did you, part of it was power scaling. Like, some of it was just like weird. Like, I'm sorry. Did you just do that? But you can't really? Okay. Maybe this is explained later. Like, you know, there's always that fallacy of, like, maybe they explain it later.
And then they never mention it again.
And then it doesn't get explained in a satisfactory way. But there's just a lot of things that happen in that movie, and you're just like, all right, you've lost me. What the heck is going on here? What is this?
Oh,
this scene
God.
Is going on for way too long. What the heck? And then, yeah, at that point, I'm just finishing the movie to finish it. But, it was such a weird experience. I feel like I still had a couple of moments like that in Belle. I liked Belle a lot. It was a very, very well animated, beautiful movie. And they did borrow, like, a bunch of scenes from Beauty and the Beast. And I wasn't expecting it until I saw it. I was like, oh, I get it. Belle like Beauty and the Beast. I see. And there were a few very recognizable key scenes that were basically taken, like, right out of the original animated Disney movie, Beauty and the Beast. And obviously, it doesn't tell that story. Like, it takes that story and completely reinterprets it. I think even to say that it was loosely inspired by it is kind of generous. But there are certain things that happen with respect to live streaming, something that we're both quite familiar with, that I'm like, that doesn't make sense. No, that just does not make sense. Like, why would you have that? What is live streaming just always on? Like, why would that be caught on a stream? Anyway, so there were a few things that just, like, really annoyed me, and I did actually just, like, blurt out something that was bothering me. But it is only something I do if I get to a certain threshold of upset.
Damn. Damn. I looked it up while you were talking about it. It looks really good.
It's so beautiful. Like, actually, it's worth watching. The niggly little things only bother you if you think too deeply about it. And I sometimes think too deeply about things.
Very fair. Oh.
It is gorgeous. I will watch it with you if you want me to. We have it. It's just, you know, keep in mind that whenever you watch anything like this, there's a hefty amount of, like, suspension of realism. You just have to put reality on the back burner in your brain, and you watch things, right? any sort of animated thing where people are punching spaceships, like that there's definitely some suspension of disbelief there.
You know what? Zenshu. That's what it was for me. The anime from a couple seasons ago, Zenshu, about the animator who got isekai'd into like the last tale. No, there were so many times where I was just like, this is just so much bullshit. It is really, really hard to suspend my disbelief right now.
Yep. Yep. Ugh. But, well, you know what? At least you've reached a certain level of mastery when it comes to drawing, such that you have really good fundamentals, especially when it comes to composition.
Well,
to be able to recognize when things are just wrong.
Well, you might say that. But no, I'm such a heckin' amateur. I'm so weak. Oh my god. So the other week I bought myself like a new tablet, a new Android tablet. And as part of my projects to get used to it, I was opening up Krita, I was doing some work, and I wanted to work on doing some background art. Including perspective, because honestly, whenever you're drawing like an environment, even if it's a 2D environment, no matter what you're doing, getting at least some two-point perspective going will help you a lot in giving it depth, giving it feeling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was drawing, I set up everything, and I was like, yes, this looks really nice. I've got a 60-degree field of view within my two-point perspective zone. And
wow.
I was drawing the stuff in there, and there was one fundamental thing that I didn't think about. So I was drawing a convenience store, Combini specifically, with a K truck in front of it. And I was so proud of myself. It was perspective to hell, and I was really enjoying it. And then I was like, wait a minute. I'm looking at this, and things don't look like they're exactly on the thirds axis. I didn't take into account the rule of thirds at all. And so I looked at my zone, I did the math, I figured out where the thirds lines are, drew them on there, and realized nothing. Nothing that I wanted people to look at was on the thirds axes.
No.
Yeah.
Oh,
now,
sadness.
I wasn't at like the good lining. I wasn't at the final lining stage. It was more of just like a final sketch, if you will, before I get into like inking and painting and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with perspective, you can't simply resize things. If you can't move things around No, because then you have to redo all of the perspective.
Mm-hmm. You have to basically erase it all and then put it somewhere else.
So I did the only thing that made sense. I resized what my zone was going to be to actually like get things closer to those thirds, which kind of warps one side. That means that one side isn't exactly like a 60-degree field of view, which is supposedly closer to like photography or real life for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
I am an amateur. I don't 100% understand things. But if you wanted to do like a background of near field things, but with perspective, like a 60-degree field of view is a good field of view to work with. And so the right side is going to be just a little bit more warped than the left side. It might be mildly fisheyed in a direction, which I hope isn't a big deal at the end of the day.
It was on purpose. Yes. Just say it was on purpose.
I mean, I can tell other people it was on purpose if anybody notices. But I'll know.
It was all intentionally part of the artistic journey.
It literally was part of the artistic journey. If I wanted to be a better artist about it, I could be like, Well, it is what it is. I'll have to go shift things over a little bit. And, you know, it was only just... It was still the sketch phase. Not very close to the lining phase. I was literally two steps away from lining.
Oof.
Well, I guess I could just redraw the whole thing again in sketch and then... But no. No. I'm happy where it is. After I'd got the things that I want to be on the thirds axis, there was like the door to the Combini and the cab of the K-truck specifically that I wanted to be on the thirds axis.
Mm-hmm.
And now it will look better. It will look nice. And I can live with that.
Okay.
I can live with that.
It's fine. We
exactly.
All
are... Exactly.
I start drawing on my iPad more.
Yeah, well, that's half the reason I bought my tablet. I just want something where it is one device, and I can just draw. Mm-hmm. I don't expect to do, like, good finishing art on this screen for a couple reasons. I doubt its color accuracy. I don't 100% believe its color accuracy. And just a 13-inch tablet screen that is also, like, almost 4K resolution is just really hard to do fine detail on. But doing sketches and things of that nature are absolutely something that is good for.
Just zoom your canvas in, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Simply zoom.
Just zoom. Zoom. Do all the detail work and zoom.
Don't zoom in too far. This is actually artist pro tip. Don't zoom in too far. If you find that you're doing a lot of detail work at 200% zoom, stop it. Zoom out.
Oh, man.
No, legitimately. Man. This is actually an artist pro tip. Much better artists than I am will tell you this.
I know, and I know that.
And
but...
my problem is, because I started with pixel art, where I care about every single pixel. When I'm doing high-res art, I want to care about every single pixel. And that's really easy to do when you have... maybe 128 individual pixels. When you have somewhere in the order of 50 million pixels, that's not something you can do.
But I like zooming in and doing faces.
Just do face. Just do zoom in to like a 4,000 by 8,000 pixel picture. And do, like, a 32-pixel little smiley face on someone's toe hair. Yeah. Nobody else will know it's there, but you'll know. And that's what really matters.
I don't have to zoom in that far, but I definitely zoom in really far when I'm doing eyes and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Point taken. I just have to frame things nicer.
Especially for things like eyes. You should stay zoomed out so you can see both eyes at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
That is actually a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Especially for things like eyes, hands, anything where it's paired, you want to be able to see both of them at the same time so you can make sure that you're not doing anything too egregious.
I was definitely very bad at keeping hands the same size.
Hands are hard. They're just hard.
Hands in general, just like fingers. What are those? Everybody's got clampy hands.
Exactly. Exactly.
Nobody
and
wants
we'll
me to
clamp our hands around next week's episode.
Clamps.
Clamps. The clamps.
Clamp you next time.